Well, I'm not going to bail out the Old Testament people. Far be it from me. Mark 9:30-37. And before we jump into the text, a few observations about the context. Of course, we're in the section of Mark where Jesus is on the way. Up through the healing of the first blind man in chapter 8, Jesus is in Galilee, or using Galilee as a base to go into Gentile territory. And after the second blind man healing, blind Bartimaeus, he's only in Jerusalem. And in this middle section, he is on the way, and of course, they hardly ever get anywhere. What's more important than where they get is what happens while they are on the way. And the whole point of this section is now where Jesus withdraws from the crowds, withdraws from opposition in general, from the Pharisees, and teaches his disciples, specifically his mission, and what it means to be one who follows this Jesus. So it's very much a discipleship chapter or section, and not so much a revelatory, here's the kingdom of God as you have in Galilee, nor the completion of his work in Jerusalem. It's discipleship is the theme here. And that fits exactly with this pericope. The question is, how do you follow this guy? Now this section, 30-37, is sort of the poor man's passion prediction. Because the first one is, you know, all this big glorious thing. You got this thing about Peter, get behind me, Satan. We all know that one. The last one comes right before he enters Jerusalem, and you get that, it's followed by the dispute among the disciples about who's going to sit at the right and the left. So this one in the middle sort of doesn't add anything, really. And even what follows, where you have the disciples disputing, you got the same thing in chapter 10 again. So it's sort of it's just a simple little pericope. I think what we want to do, however, is focus on what makes this one unique. And that is, in fact, in the instruction given in verse 36 and following. What's also interesting is right before this is that pericope where the disciples don't want somebody who's not part of them to do any ministry. So they're not serving someone who is serving Christ. And they're trying to keep it to themselves, in a sense. And then following this is scandalizing little ones and sin. Cast into the lake of fire, all this warning sort of thing. So, to the text. Mark 9:30. Kakethen ex elephantes para pruanta dia tes galileas. From there, heirs participle of exergamai, having gotten up, they passed through, and here's one of Mark's, you stick a compound verb followed by a preposition, so they passed through Galilee. Why you have to do it twice, I don't know, but he does quite often. They pass through Galilee, and Kaihu Ethelon Hina Tisknoi. And he did not wish, and here this odd Hina plus a subjunctive, Gnoi there is the aorist subjunctive of Gnosko. They did not wish that anyone would know, or someone would know, meaning anyone would know. Typically you'd see an infinitive here. But in Mark, hina plus the subjunctive is almost the same as an infinitive, so he does the former here. All right. What's key about this, again, is Jesus wasn't wanting anybody to know where he was. He's avoiding the crowds. And as I said before, that's verse 31, he's teaching his disciples. So verse 31, et didas gen gar tu smathetas autu kai elegan autois. Notice he was teaching his disciples, and he have a gar. So the gar and the teaching explains why he didn't want anyone to know. See, this is teaching for those who are supposed to be followed. This isn't what the crowds get. This isn't for the masses. This is for those who are supposed to be following this guy who called him out and literally said, follow me, and I'll make you fishers of people and those sorts of things. So he didn't want anybody to know. He wants to talk to his disciples. And what does he tell them? Again, the second passion prediction, and all three are given only to the disciples. Because apparently they're supposed to figure this out. Which, of course, they don't, but they're supposed to. What does he say to them? Hati hahuyas tu anthropu, paradidata es keras anthropon. Saying to them that the Son of Man, and this is great practice for tenses in this pericope, paradidata, future tense, from paradidomi, will be handed over into the the hands of people. Men, usually, but it's non-gender specific, into the hands of people. What will they do to him? Kai apoptenosynauton, they will kill him. Kai apoptan thais, or face. Here's a nice aorist passive participle from apokteno. And having been killed, metatres hemeros anastasitai. Having been killed, after 3 days, he will rise. He will get up, anastemi. This is the standard verb for that action. So, very simple passion prediction. Not going into details about mocking or whipping or betraying like you have in the other predictions. It's really just, what do you have here? Well, you do have handed over. Handed over, killed, rise. Three things happen. So pretty simple, and you got to go to the other ones to get the bigger story. But again, the point of this is not so much the prediction as it is what happens after the prediction, the teaching afterwards. Now 32 highlights this theme of the disciples really not understanding what's going on. Egnaun tafema kai epabunto aton eperotesa. That's a great looking form there. Egnaun. It's from Agnoeo, which is an epsilon contract, which is why you have the typical on ending for the imperfect shifted to the un. But you have to have the omicron from Agnoeo, because that's the stem. So you end up with two omicrons next to each other, which you don't see too often, but it's because of the contract and the omicron as part of the stem. So anyway, the imperfect tense here gives us, they were not understanding the saying. The imperfect is a durative, continuous action in past time. They were not understanding the saying, frame of their spoken utterance. And effabunto, we're going to see this verb actually a few times in the rest of Mark now. Once when the disciples are afraid to follow him into Jerusalem, and another time when the women are afraid after the announcement of the resurrection. So phobetoing is not a good thing in the Gospel of Mark. It's an indication that you do not understand what's happening, and because you do not understand, you are not able to follow. Instead, you fear. In fact, we saw this in chapter 4 with the calming of the storm. The disciples feared a great fear. It's actually a cognate accusative there. They're super scared. It's always a lack of understanding and ability to follow faithfully. Again, what's important here is the imperfects. It's durative conditions. And actually, just like we had in chapter 4 with the calming of the storm, they didn't ask him. They didn't ask him about the saying. They didn't ask him who he was at the calming of the storm. The disciples here are just sort of completely, you know, I don't know how you describe it, clueless, passive, unable to get out of their own situation. They don't know, and they don't know what to do about their not knowing. They're hopeless. And that's actually how the gospel ends, except the guy actually came back to life. But that's another story. All right. So the disciples are clueless, and then the teaching follows. What's interesting about all three of the passion predictions in Mark, well, in all the synoptics, but after all three of the passion predictions, there is a teaching on discipleship. And it's connected with the passion prediction. So it's never just, oh, by the way, I'm going to die and rise, and let's talk about the weather. Okay? It's, I'm going to die and rise, and what does this mean for you who are my followers? That because I have died and risen, you now get to follow me, which looks like this. Okay? And of course, they aren't able to do it until after the resurrection. But Jesus, if you want to call it exhortations or teachings on discipleship, are never disconnected from his own work. And specifically here, of course, Jesus' death and resurrection serves, and the disciples are called to serve, so it's a fairly obvious connection to make. Verse 33. Here they actually get somewhere. Kai elthon eis Capernaum. Nice word there. They come into Capernaum. Kai ente oikia genomenos epirota autus. And being in the house, he asked them. interesting, there's no indication of anything that was going on the way, but they get to the place, and Jesus asks a question. Ti te en te hodo dialogiteste. Te, with the accent down there, tells us that's an interrogative, not just an indefinite. So what, on the way, and here's that phrase, on the way again, it's one of eight occurrences, I think it's eight, seven or eight occurrences in chapters 8, 9, 10. What on the way did you discuss? Dialogemai here. Did you discuss? It wasn't not dispute here, but discuss. Verse 34, because they're idiots, oida esiopon, right? But they kept on being silent. They didn't want to volunteer any information that would condemn them. So they didn't say anything because pros aleluskar dialekteson en te hado tismezon. To one another, they were discussing on the way who mezon. Nice comparative form from megas. Megas means big, and mezon would be the comparative bigger. But here, they're probably not disputing their weightlifting abilities, but their status in the kingdom. So they were discussing with one another on the way, who is the greater of them, is the implied thing you got to fill in. So what does Jesus do? You got to picture the Gospel of Mark as a movie. And you really have to sort of picture the scene. So, you know, the disciples are sort of standing around. Jesus asks, what are you disputing on the road? The disciples are kind of looking down at their feet, shuffling around, you know. And then they were discussing on the road who is the greater. And Jesus, you got to picture Jesus as one of these, oh, geez, you know, kind of a look of resignation on his face. How many times do we have to go through this sort of a thing? They must have acted this thing out, I think, when they, you know, when Mark did this first. It must have been a play or something. But anyway, let's see. Having sat down, kai kathisas, erista from Kathizo, having sat down at phone sentu stereka kai legautois, he called the 12. Notice again, the specific teaching goes only to the 12 here, and says to them, Etesele protas enai estai panton eskatas kai panton diakonos. If somebody wishes to be first, so first equivalent of greater, great test, he will be, estai the future, last of all and one who serves all, diakonos of all. Here, it's diakonos servant, not doulos slave. And I think that's actually sort of intentional. Diakonia, serving one another, taking care of one another, is the point in this pericope. So again, it's this way that Jesus has of turning things upside down. You want to be greater, you be the last. And being last is being the servant. So this is going to inform them, his little parable in 36 and 37. Of course, diakonos is exactly what Jesus is going to do himself on the cross. Now, 36. A nice little living parable. Kai labon, kai dion, este sen auta en mezo auton, kai, well, let's go that far. And taking a child, he stood it. Well, it's a grammatical neuter. It's not a gender, male-female neuter. It's just a grammatical neuter. Male-female, it doesn't matter. Took the child and stood him, stood her in their midst, right in the middle of them, right in mezzo. Kai enan kalisamenos. If you know what that is without looking it up, you're better than me. Enan kalidzo is, or actually enan kalidzo mai, is to put your arms around, or to take hold of. It's a deponent verb, so you have the middle passive participle form there, which actually is an active because it's a deponent verb. So placing his hands upon or taking into his arms it, the child, he says to them, the disciples, Hosan hen ton toyuton haidion dexetai epito onomatu mu. Whoever hen, the difference between hen and en is just the breathing mark. Hen is the rough and en is the smooth breathing. Whoever receives one of such children as these, whoever receives a child like this or something like this, in my name, right? Because you are of Christ, is another way to say that. Because you belong to me, because you are one of my followers, eme deketai, receives me. Let me finish this and I'll get into the textual problem. Kai hus an eme deketai, uk eme deketai ala ton apostelaka me. The accent has to shift there at the end. All right. And whoever receives me does not receive me, rather, the one who sent, the heirs there, who sent me. Now, let's talk about the textual variant real quick, just because it's kind of fun, and Andy talked about some for his, so I'm going to do it too. The hen, you notice there's that little bracket in front of the hen in verse 37, which means there's a substitution. If you look down in your apparatus, you see the bracket is, what is it, three lines down on the right side, 37-ek, which is read by W Theta Family 13565 and the old Latin tradition. Now, what the heck does that mean? Whoever receives from one of such children as these receives me. So the table is sort of reversed. You actually receive from a child. I'll talk about it in a second. The other alternative reading is in Codex Bezae, Gamma, a few others, some old Latin witnesses, and the Syriac, which should give you pause because those are pretty early witnesses, which does not have the preposition at all, and would be read simply as a genitive, whoever receives of these little children. And so now you can see where the heck would have been inserted, because it just clarifies what the genitive would be. Which is a pretty interesting reading. I'm not quite sure what to do with it, but it does make it kind of interesting. Not only are you to receive children like this, but you are to put yourself under them. Because, of course, in Jewish society, what are children? They're not things that you paint new baby rooms for and buy $5,000 worth of furniture and go nuts on. They're a pain. They're stupid, they're ignorant, they're useless until they can start working around the house and in the fields and pulling their own weight. They're a drain, in fact. And so why does Jesus pull a little child and put it in front of him and say, serve this one? It's because nobody wants to serve that. That's the least thing you could be is to be a child. And so Jesus' point is, if you're going to serve a child, you serve everybody, right? But this alternative reading, interestingly, would be you're actually going to receive from them. It's probably wrong, but heck, Origen does it. He can make the two readings say the same thing, so I'll do the same thing too. What's the main point anyway? And the real key is in 37, obviously, where the pericope ends. Mark has this nasty habit of ending pericopes with these sort of pithy sayings of Jesus and then not explaining them. So you're sort of left hanging and you got to ponder it for a minute. So what the heck would it mean if by serving a child or welcoming a child, receiving a child, we're not receiving the child but receiving Jesus, and even further, we're not receiving Jesus but the one who sent Jesus. So what is going on here? It's sort of a little different from what you have in the Grace and the Kingdom in chapter 10, where there it simply is serve one another, slave of all, doulos is in fact used there. Here you got the extension that by serving a child, you actually serve God. See that? Which isn't a point made in chapter 10. And I think the reason Jesus makes this extension here is that this is not merely sort of here's some nice things to do, or here's a law or something like this that you have to follow. But Jesus here actually ties together the first and the second tables of the law. To receive God, to worship Him, right, to serve Him is the first table. To serve your neighbor is the second table. And what Jesus is saying is when you do one, you do the other, and when you do the other, you do the one. That you can't separate out service of God and service of your neighbor. It's the same thing. And this is the problem, of course, of the rich young ruler. He wanted to serve God, but not his neighbor. Jesus wouldn't let him do it. We don't have the long discussion here, but I think the same point is being made. in the act of serving one another, we are in fact worshiping the Lord. We're putting Him first in our lives by serving even the least. It's certainly an exhortation teaching text and an application we certainly want to talk about. Who is the least in our society? Who are the least in our community that we typically don't serve? And certainly there's a call to do that. But even greater than that, why do we do it? It's simply because this is worship of God, who has made me His own, who has given His life for me and taken it up again, who I follow, and by doing this, I am serving Him. And it just kind of goes in a circle, I suppose. By serving God, God serves us, and it just kind of never ends. And I guess that's sort of the point. Nobody wins or loses when it comes to serving in the church, serving in the world. God takes care of us, we take care of others, and others take care of us, and God gets worship, and it just kind of looks like the kingdom of God, and like it's going to look on the last day. So go ahead and start doing it now, I guess is the point. I don't know, any comments or observations on this?
So you actually think he's talking about serving others?
Sort of.
And not just explain what it means to be the least.
Oh, no. No, not just explain what it means to be, because if you're the least,
you actually might do something.
If you're the least, you have to serve somebody else. So that's the point. If you're not the one calling the shots, you got to serve. You don't have a choice. So you make yourself least, you make yourself a servant, you have to do the master's will. Yeah. So it's not just, let's get the hierarchy straight. It's what are you supposed to be doing?